This is KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Tuesday, July 12th of 2022. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's show, we'll visit with volunteer firefighters training for an extended fire season and predicted heat wave. How salt can predict rain? We'll have that story and more on This Week in Water. And our friends at Rocky Mountain Community Radio will explore seasons of rock art on the Colorado Plateau. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have an update from the BBC News headlines. Then it's How on Earth? Today's science show features part one of a two-part interview with the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporting authors of Salmon Wars. The book's publication debut is today. At 9 a.m. comes Alan Watts, the British philosopher, writer, and speaker known for interpreting Eastern religious ideas for a Western audience. Then at 9:30, Ginger Perry will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. All that's still ahead, but first, it's time for local and regional headlines with KGNU's Jim Swenson.
Boulder's Park and Recreation Department was awarded $25,000 to help train and retain lifeguards this week. The grant will help facilities at North Boulder Recreation Center and the outdoor Scott Carpenter Pool. Due to staffing shortages, these pools have had to run on a limited schedule. The Spruce Pool has not opened this summer at all. Some of the incentives that are being introduced include a $1 an hour bonus for those lifeguards that work through the Labor Day weekend and a referral bonus of $100 for those that work for the city for 50 hours. Community members who are interested in becoming a lifeguard can apply at bprjobs.org. Denver opened a new window for e-bike rebate applications yesterday. It has received so much public interest that it had to limit the applicants to income-qualified participants. The previous round of applications launched on Earth Day, and so many people applied that funds depleted within 3 weeks. The program allows rebates of $400 on an e-bike and $900 for a cargo bike. Income-qualified residents are eligible for a $1,200 rebate for an e-bike and $1,700 for cargo bikes. According to a City of Denver press release, users who were trying to become email verified overwhelmed the system, knocking the application platform offline for between a half hour and 2 hours. When the applicants did not receive verification, some attempted to reapply, thereby invalidating their old verification and starting the half hour to 2 hour wait over again. Since the inception of the program, 848 e-bike rebates have been fulfilled. The program will limit the number of rebates offered each month for the remaining 6 months of the year to ensure that the program can last through 2022. National parks were big draws for tourists last year. Visitors lined up across the country to enter the national park system more than 297 million times, up 25% from 2020. These visits meant a lot of spending in nearby communities. Rocky Mountain Community Radio's Justin Higginbottom reports on a new study which crunches the numbers.
Last year, visitors lined up across the country to enter the national park system more than 297 million times. That's up 25% from 2020. Those visitors spent around $20.5 billion within 60 miles of those parks. That spending is up 41%. This comes from a new report by the Park Service. According to the authors, much of that increase in visitation and spending has to do with recovering from a pandemic year. In 2020, less park facilities were open. The study says that nationally, the lodging sector saw the highest direct effects of visitor spending. Next was restaurants. And this all might be an underestimate. The agency used a new method to survey visitors at Zion. The results show visitors spent more time and money during their trips than previously thought. Justin Higginbottom for Rocky Mountain Community Radio.
The town of Lyons will get another month to discuss whether or not Boulder County should strike a deal with CEMEX, a Mexico-based cement production company. For years, CEMEX has been one of the worst polluters in the state, dumping 350,000 tons of carbon into the air each year. This summer, they applied for a mining permit, and in exchange for the permit, they offered to make a deal. CEMEX said that if they get the permit to mine, they will close their Lyons coal-fired plant in 15 years and give the land back to Boulder Open Space. Boulder County Open Space initially endorsed the deal, but after protests from community members and Lyons officials, have decided to open the decision back up for public discussion. Community members have another month to weigh in on the proposal. Lyons Mayor Holly Rogan told the Colorado Sun that the community thinks both the options presented have risks and would like to find a third option. She said she and community members in Lyons will continue to look for a deal that works for everyone. The Humane Society of Boulder Valley is hosting free adoptions for dogs 1 year and older now through Sunday. Adoptions for dogs usually cost $150. More than 30 dogs at the shelter are looking for homes and are current on their shots and health checks. In addition to the free adoption, Sunnyside is also offering 25% off their products and free crates. More information is available at boulderhumane.org. The 14th annual Tube to Work Day is this Friday, July 15th. It will be a return for what, until 2020, had been an annual tradition. The pandemic put a 2-year pause on the event, which historically draws hundreds of participants in life jackets, helmets, and business suits or costumes to the waterway of Boulder Creek. Billed as the world's greatest traffic jam, the aquatic commute starts at Eben G. Fine Park, where participants will enter Boulder Creek, then tube onto their place of employment. Wetsuits are encouraged as the starting time is 8 a.m. The registration fee includes a hot coffee and a light breakfast. 25% of all proceeds will go to Boulder Bridge House. Registration is now officially open with only 800 spots available. According to the National Weather Service, there is a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms, mainly between 3 and 4 p.m. Increasing clouds with high near 92. Light and variable wind becoming north-northwest 5 to 9 miles per hour in the afternoon. Outside the Boulder studio is currently 68 degrees. For KGNU, I'm James Swenson.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. Emergency responders in the Front Range have been recruiting and training volunteers to build local capacity to fight wildfires. KGNU's Rosanna Longo-Better spoke with Fritz Koch, firefighting training captain of Boulder Rural Fire and chair of the Boulder County Cooperators, about preparing not only the forest, but also our homes for the fire season.
We are at Calwood Education, and we are training the next round of wildland firefighters. So we have 35 students here that have been in class for 3 days, and now we have 2 days in the field. And they're learning to use their hand tools and how to simulate firefighting without live fire.
How does a person sign in for this? How do you get to where these people are right now learning how to deal with wildfires?
Each of them is a member of one of the volunteer agencies and some of the career agencies around Boulder County. And so they've signed up through the course for the course through their agencies. Agencies provided the gear that they need, and we come on out and do what we do.
And what are the requisites?
We defer to the agencies. If you are a member of the agency for whatever reason, then as long as the agency endorses you, covers your workman's comp insurance and so forth. But this is the entry-level class, so you really don't have to have any background whatsoever to do it. We stress that you need to be physically fit, because obviously we're hiking up and down a lot of hills and working hard throughout the day. But anybody can sign up and join us. And we're whole volunteer fire world is lacking firefighters at this point, so we take all we can get.
If you can speak about how you are preparing for this.
Well, we were off to a very early start. We didn't expect to be fighting fires. You know, we started with December 30th, before the year even ended, with some of our worst fires in Colorado history. And we got a little bit of snow after that, and we were pretty much fighting fire all the way through spring. This class we usually try to get done before we really hit prime fire season, and yet we've already had a significant season. So drought is something that we're watching, and unfortunately we have very little control over. So it's a matter of just trying to stay alert with your weather conditions and what's going on with the environment, and try to increase staffing whenever possible. And so we'll look and, for example, the next several days are lining out. So we have been broadcasting the weather every hour up here so that in a real fire situation, everyone would know, hey, this is the change that's going on throughout the day. Then we have a longer term look on that, and we start looking 2-3 days out and, you know, 6 months back, I don't know, down to a week back, and just try to make the best of it. We're just more the responders that are out there. We have very little control over, you know, we can't make this stop, but we can do our best to deal with it.
Here in Calwood, there's like a way of preparing the land or trying to manage the land so that way you get less exposure to fires. Is there any recommendation that you will like to provide for those that are living up here in the mountains?
Absolutely. Well, there's, you know, wildfire mitigation will come up. And if you look around, you'll see many of these trees don't have the lower branches on them. Those have been cut off. And those are what we call ladder fuel. So that prevents the fire, if it's just a simple fire down in the grasses, from crawling up into the trees. So mitigation and removing trees and thinning is a huge part of it. And one of the simplest things that I recommend for homeowners is to walk around your house and look anywhere that you're collecting pine needles, leaves, anything like that. That is where the wind is swirling, and it's collecting those leaves in that spot. If you have a fire near you, the exact same place is where the embers are going to land. So now you have that receptive fuel bed, and you're potentially dropping an ember right into that. And that's where you're going to have your most problems. So when you find those spots, clean those up, but also pay attention to everything about your home construction in that location. Do you have gaps in your siding? Do you have vents in the roof? Do you have anywhere that that ember could kind of nest in and start a fire?
How can people get more advice, personal advice, if they are having questions about their buildings?
Easiest way would be to reach out to your local fire department, and they probably have full staff ready to come out and do a home assessment. Boulder County has a number of groups that will offer their services depending on where you live, but start with your local fire department and they can point you in the right place.
Finally, just to wrap it up, if you can describe what this group of people, these volunteer firefighters, have been doing today. A whole day in Cottonwood. I'm sure they're exhausted.
Well, we started with a couple hours of instruction of saying this is the different hand tools that we use in the fire service and this is how you use them appropriately. And while that was happening, we had some other firefighters going around and creating a simulated fire. And so they created a little mock fire perimeter up here on the hillside. And then we bring in the crews and say, all right, this is your fire. Now anchor, flank, and pinch is one of the terms that we use. You create an anchor point, and then you flank the fire, and you pinch off the head of the fire, one of the techniques that we use. And so then they're just led with instructors who are also firefighters leading them and answering all their questions and showing them how to do it correctly and safely.
As we were walking up to find you, to find your crew, we just saw that you have the ambulance down there and it's running. It's on. Why do you have it on? And is that part of this learning process?
Not so much part of the learning process as just a safety consideration that I wanted to make sure if somebody were injured that we had the means to tend to them immediately. And so we have asked the ambulance, and AMR has been very kind in donating the service to be here for the full weekend. And so they have a firefighter and a paramedic, or I'm sorry, a EMT and a paramedic staged here. And we're going to simply provide them a little dinner and thank them for their services. And thankfully, we have not needed them, but very glad to have them here.
Last message that you would like to send it out there. Maybe there's somebody else that would like to be part of this group of volunteer firefighters, especially now that we're getting these heat waves coming. And we need to get ready.
Well, I guess kind of going back to where I started, reach out to your local fire department. If there's a volunteer department in the area, if you're living in a city, you probably have a career department. Our website is BOCOfire, BOCOfire.org. And we post courses there all the time. And many of them don't have any prerequisites. So there's a little contact us link there that comes to me. And I answer any questions that I get. So happy to help however we can. It always feels good, and it's just something that Colorado and throughout the West really needs at this point.
Thank you so much. For KGNU, I am Rosanna Longobetter.
Time now for the latest edition of This Week in Water with Jamie Sudler and Franny Halperin.
How salt can predict rain. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Last week, millions in the Sydney, Australia area faced flooding after rain amounts that used to fall in 8 months came down in just 4 days.
For the past 2 years, the region has been dealing with wet weather brought on by back-to-back La Niña conditions, and now it looks as though they, and also we, may be in for a third episode of the phenomenon that impacts global weather patterns.
La Niña, or the little girl, describes a condition in the tropical Pacific Ocean in which the sea temperatures cool in contrast to El Niño, the little boy that brings warming waters.
La Niña, which according to NOAA is near record intensity for this time of year, can create conditions more favorable for tropical storms and hurricanes thousands of miles away in the Atlantic Ocean. They also worsen droughts and wildfires in the southwestern U.S.
The World Meteorological Organization says ongoing droughts in southern parts of South America and the Horn of Africa, plus the rainfall in Southeast Asia and Australia, bear the hallmarks of La Niña.
The organization recently concluded that there's a 70% chance La Niña will stay in place at least until August and maybe into fall and winter. A third season with those conditions is relatively rare, occurring only twice since 1950. Some researchers warn that triple La Niñas could happen more in the future because of climate change.
Faraway oceans can be a tool for farmers and others in the U.S. Midwest to know when to plant, fertilize, or prepare for floods.
According to a study led by Pennsylvania State University, the salt content of surface waters of the Atlantic Ocean and Gulf of Mexico miles from the Corn Belt can predict heavy summer rains.
When water evaporates, the sea surface gets a bit saltier, and that's an indicator of the amount of moisture carried by the atmosphere and where it will rain.
The scientists looked at about 70 years of rainfall in the Midwest and compared it to both salinity and sea temperatures in the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. Salinity was over 90% more accurate than temperature in predicting extreme events.
In 1993, the Great Flood along the Mississippi and Missouri rivers caused about $15 billion in damages, which the researchers say might have been lessened if forecasters had been able to use the salinity-based data to plan for extreme rainfall.
Finland has long, dark, and cold winters, and up until recently had relied in small part on imported Russian energy to provide light and heat. That supply came to an end with the invasion of Ukraine and Moscow's irritation at Finland's application to join NATO.
Luckily, Finland has been investing in wind and solar, but as is the case with renewables, storing the energy so that supply meets demand is a challenge.
Currently, lithium-ion batteries are a dominant storage technology, but they're expensive and have environmental impacts, especially to water, as mining 1 ton of the metal requires over 2 million gallons.
But a startup in Finland called Polar Night Energy might have a dirt-cheap solution, or rather a sandy one. They have installed the world's first commercial sand battery, which can store green energy for months.
Their solution involves a silo filled with around 100 tons of sand that's heated to over 500 degrees Celsius using electricity generated by wind and solar. The sand retains the heat, as anyone walking on a hot beach can tell you, and then when needed, it warms water in a piped network that heats nearby homes, offices, and even the local swimming pool.
Other research groups are looking into sand batteries, but the Finnish version is up and running, and they say their next challenge is to see if their concept can be used to generate electricity in addition to providing heat.
And finally, from the Finns to southern Finn whales, which are the second largest cetaceans after blue whales. They're known to be super fast swimmers, but their speed could not prevent nearly all of the creatures from being slaughtered in the 20th century as hunters decimated populations for their oil.
But thanks to a ban on commercial whaling since 1976, scientists believe the southern Finn whales are rebounding, especially after a group of researchers came across the largest gathering of the animals ever documented off the coast of Antarctica.
During an expedition in 2018 to study the effects of climate change on krill, which are a favorite meal for fin whales, researchers observed around 100 of the animals feasting away. On a return trip in 2019, they counted up to 150 fin whales chowing down krill at the same location.
Having an increase in whale numbers benefits an ocean ecosystem because as they eat, the animals release iron in their poop, which can fuel the growth of phytoplankton or microalgae that krill feed on. Greater populations of whales also benefit the climate because the algae absorb CO2 from the atmosphere as they photosynthesize.
Following the research, the whale's status has been upgraded to vulnerable, but the animals still face threats from ship strikes, warming waters, or getting entangled in fishing gear. But an undeniable takeaway is that conservation efforts can and do work.
That's it for This Week in Water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
In his new book titled Tracing Time, Seasons of Rock Art on the Colorado Plateau, local author Craig Childs takes readers on a journey that deeply examines certain rock art panels in the region. For KVNF and Rocky Mountain Community Radio, Laura Palmisano interviews Childs from his home in Norwood.
Describe some types of rock art scattered across the Colorado Plateau.
I guess the basic kind are petroglyphs and pictographs, petroglyphs being pecked into a rock and pictographs being painted on it. And you know, you see hunting scenes, you see rituals, you see spirit figures, you see so much, and you know, spirals all over the place. So many spirals, which you know, you get into the meaning of them, and meanings just trail off in multiple directions, but you know, spirals being wind, water, time, the movement of seasons. Some rock art is associated with light coming through cracks or coming over boulders at sunrise, and daggers of light landing on spirals marking certain times of the year. So a lot of different kinds of rock art.
In your new book, you write, rock art has long been treated as a minor character in archaeology. Why is that?
Probably because it's much harder to define than artifacts or trenches where you can see stratigraphy and dates all lined up, and you know, arrowheads and potsherds and charcoal that you can date. And rock art is more like art. It's, you know, it's hard to define. You can kind of get timelines down by looking at different styles, but what did the original maker intend, and how is this seen by the culture at the time? How is it seen by descendant cultures now? It's much harder to wrap your head around than an artifact that is really easy to define or relatively easy to define.
How was rock art maybe used to manifest the needs and desires of its creators?
Yeah, that's a good question, because it's hard to tell what exactly it was, especially when you're going back over 1,000 years, 2,000 or 3,000 years. What did this convey for that person who made it, or that those people who were here? It's hard to say. You know, what is the difference between ritual and everyday life? And it seems like rock art is more about ritual and less about depicting necessarily events, although there are many sites where you can say, okay, that is a group of people walking all in one direction carrying baskets on their backs. This is a migration, or this is a trade route. But then you're looking at a much older culture where the world is animated, where everything is considered alive. The clouds are people, the ants and the birds are people. And you know, rock art was maybe a different form of people, not so much history as we see it now, but living animated characters in stone.
How would you describe this new book, and what do you hope people take away from it?
Well, this book was 30 years of intense travel in rock art landscapes, kind of boiled down to a year and a half of me just focusing deeply on certain panels, spending a lot of time there. And what I'm wanting the book to be is time spent in places with ancestry, and watching the sunrise, watching days pass, watching light move across these walls. I want people to take away from this book that rock art isn't just decoration or graffiti necessarily. It is a cultural story, many different cultural stories written across the landscape. And when you start putting them together, you realize that, oh, these are stories told from canyon to canyon and mesa to mesa. This is essentially a book. The Colorado Plateau is an open book, and you may not know what you're reading. In fact, you won't know what you're reading, but you will know that these are important sites, that these had meaning, even if you don't know what the meaning is.
Thank you for joining us, Craig.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That was local author Craig Childs discussing his new book, Tracing Time, Seasons of Rock Art on the Colorado Plateau. For KVNF, I'm Laura Palmisano.
Tonight on Hemispheres, join host Joe Ritchie as he takes us on a passage through India with David Barsamian. That's host Joe Ritchie with David Barsamian tonight on Hemispheres at 6.
That's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. Thanks to James Swinson, Justin Higginbottom, Alexis Kenyon, Rosanna Longo-Better, Jamie Sudler, Franny Halperin, and Laura Palmisano for their contributions to today's program. I've been your host, Shannon Young. Stay tuned for How on Earth. That's coming up just after these news headlines from the BBC.